This is Peace Talks, a series of programs investigating how to make peace and pursue nonviolent solutions to conflict within ourselves, our families, our communities, and our world. I'm Suzanne Kreider with a special edition of Peace Talks. When you watch a DVD, it might include some deleted scenes that never made it to the featured film. These are the scenes the director liked, but just couldn't fit into the final version of the movie. Today's version of Peace Talks is our own deleted scenes edition. When we record our program each month, we usually tape much more discussion than we're able to fit into a half-hour program. Some of what we're forced to cut is rich with ideas and tips for resolving conflict. So today, we'll revisit a few of our previous topics and let you hear some of the never-before-released discussions on issues like mediation programs for middle school children, a verbal technology called nonviolent communication, efforts to institutionalize peace in our governing bodies, and the quest for inner peace in a post-September 11th world. First, though, how to practice peaceful parenting with Dr. Victor Lacerva, a physician who has worked in violence prevention for many years and is currently medical director of the New Mexico Department of Health's Family Health Bureau. Victor talked with us about the need to teach children emotional fluency early on in life. This is giving children the vocabulary to express emotions like mad, glad, sad, and afraid, so that they'll find it easier to label their feelings and talk about them. Later, you'll hear high school student Kevin Malone, who helped question Victor. The parents I know have a lot of guilt about not being perfect parents. And again, it seems like so many of us weren't taught emotional fluency. So we're trying to catch up. We're trying to develop some emotional intelligence. What do you tell parents who feel guilty about not being perfect parents? And how can they develop some compassion for themselves for this very difficult job?
Well, I think, you know, you basically said it all, is to have compassion for yourself, to forgive yourself when you screw up, to ask for forgiveness when you're kids, so that you're with your own children, so that you're modeling that. And I think it's a basic realization that whatever family constellation we grew up in, we all got gifts and we all got wounds. And part of the task of moving into adulthood for ourselves is to go back and learn how to celebrate the gifts and do whatever we need to do to heal some of that woundedness. You know, an easy way to get in touch with some of that is to think of one of your parents and just write at the top of the page, "I resent," and then just start kind of freehand writing. This is an exercise from a book called Making Peace with Your Parents, which I don't think is in print anymore. It was a book that came out about 15, 20 years ago. Now, it's not about sending this list FedEx to your parents once you write it, you know. It's really about you getting in touch with what you're still holding on to in terms of how you were parented. And I think that's an important part of the process, so that we become more conscious in terms of what we pass on to our children. Now, I remember moments of listening to my daughter speak to her sister in the same nasty tone of voice that I could use with her. And it hurts. You know, because you see that not only you're transmitting all the good stuff, but you're transmitting some of that stuff as well.
How do parents maintain control over particularly unruly children without any form of intimidation?
Well, I think it very much depends on the age of the child. Most of us as parents vacillate between dictator and doormat. You know, when we're in dictator mode, it's like, we want to lecture, we want to demand, we want to punish, go to your room for the rest of your life. When we're in doormat mode, we kind of want to rescue, we want to explain, let's go to your room at your earliest convenience, dear, that kind of a thing. And where we really want to be, it seems to me, is in the realm of natural consequences. And natural consequences means that we only have a few rules in the house, and those rules have consequences when they're not followed. And I think where most folks get into trouble as parents is when the rules are not clear and the consequences are not clear and there's not what I call ruthless follow-up. Now, having said all that, there is a subset of young people who just have a very difficult temperament. And there's a whole different subset of techniques that you need to use with those folks.
I have another question about the parent relationship situation. What about more of a friendship style with your parents? Do you think that that works, or do you think that that tends to lead to more problems?
Well, I think a couple of things. That as young people enter adolescence, part of their curve of emotional fluency is that they need to learn how to deal with the mood storms that come with the changes that occur in adolescence. So, for example, with my own daughters, you know, it would be like this thunderstorm of anger would roll in. She's mad. She's annoyed at everything. I'm the worst dad in the world. Parents don't understand her. School sucks. You name it. And this storm rolls in. And if I do a couple of things right, the storm, like any storm, will kind of roll out. And to try and reason with a person when they're in the midst of they're in a different part of their brain than the cognitive part of their brain. And so reasoning doesn't really help. You just kind of have to weather it out the way you weather out a storm. So what that means for the parent is, number one, don't take it personally. Just understand that right now this is what's happening. Number two, get back to those I messages that we talked about before. Number three, acknowledge where your son or daughter is at. It's fine for you to be angry at the world. Please take it into your room instead of spreading it around the living room. That kind of a thing. And then afterwards, to talk with them as a friend, as a mentor, as someone who's been through it, to help them begin to understand, well, when did this first come on? What are some things you might have done so that it didn't get so intense as a storm? Now, having said all that, I also believe that it's the job of parents, particularly when young people reach around age 10, if they haven't done it already, that they need to find 3 to 5 other caring adults who will say the same words out of their mouth about whatever it is, sex, drugs, curfew. But because it's not coming from the parent, the young person is more likely to hear it. That's a very important part of our parenting job.
Dr. Victor Lacerva with the New Mexico Department of Health. He's also the author of Pathways to Peace, 40 Steps to a Less Violent America, and most recently, World Words, Global Reflections to Awake the Spirit. Next, we'll hear some outtakes from our program that featured Chris Griscom of the Nozomi Institute of Global Consciousness. Chris is a teacher and an activist who has been working to create a Department of Peace in New Mexico state government. It's a department that would address ways to promote nonviolence, both within the state and among countries doing business with New Mexico. Questions from our audience turn to the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
For example, you're watching this war on television. That grooves itself into your brain. And that becomes, in a way, an unconscious addiction, so that it's even familiar. Most of us are comfortable with our fear. In fact, we seek it. We want to have a scary movie or read a scary book or watch something because it stimulates the adrenaline in our bodies. So yes, intellectually, we could look back. We could look back just a few years ago and see what was the result of the choices that we made, the purpose of war, the effect on our relationships as humans, etc., etc. I think there's a new way to learn, and that's what I want to bring to this world, that we could learn faster by experiencing peace. And then actually putting it to the test, because, in fact, I happen to be the mother of 6, and I'm a very pragmatic person. And, it's got to prove itself. But what I would like to see is us put it to practice so that we can realize that when we choose peace, it does something individually and collectively. And that's the way we can learn how to resolve differences, or how to love, or how to communicate, or how to work together, because this planet's getting small, and what happens to you happens to me. And those are the things that we want to learn.
I read or heard somewhere, Chris, that we literally become adrenaline junkies, that we become addicted to the chemical in our bodies. And if it's true that all this violence we're surrounded by has made us addicted to the adrenaline, how do you ever wean people from such a powerful chemical as that?
You know, I have worked for 45 years in public health and in emotional health around the world, and I learned something very early. that was thrilling to me, and it's the basis of my work now, and that is that the emotional body will just keep repeating whatever has stimulated it. And so, again, yes, that's very difficult. But what we do is that we initiate a new food to the emotional body. Can you imagine, can you remember a time when you felt ecstatic, or when you felt your heart open, or when you felt tears of joy, or you felt peace? People sometimes ask me, how would you describe peace? And I say, peace is a state of consciousness that is not looking at the past or wondering in the future. It's right there at that moment. And so how we would train people or wean them from adrenaline is to help them find and let go of and surrender into their own capacity to, excuse me for being, what would you call it, quaint, loving, happy, peaceful, unafraid, powerful. You know, when we feel powerful, it's a rush. It's just that we've learned to be powerful over another. There is nothing in the world like being powerful with another. That is human destiny, and it's the deepest cry of all humans. We're a group animal. We want approval. We want to belong. We want to link up with something or someone else. And so as we apply what we call at Nijoni, technologies of consciousness, to helping people to experience that, the emotional body will let go of that fear state very quickly when it comes into the rush of wholeness. I promise you.
Chris Griscom, an advocate for a Department of Peace in New Mexico and founder of both the Light Institute and the Nijoni School of Global Consciousness in Galisteo, New Mexico. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and you're listening to a special edition of Peace Talks. We're revisiting some of our recent programs, and you're hearing conversations that we recorded but didn't have time to air before. We think these unused segments have some good information on making peace in a variety of arenas, like middle school. As children grow up, the years between 11 to 14 can be among the toughest and can be a time when many conflicts surface. We spoke with two New Mexico mediators who work in the schools, Lily Irvin Vitella and Ellie Dendall, and with Elena Carnes, a junior at Sandia Prep High School. Ellie, you teach students and parents and teachers how to resolve conflict. I know a lot of adults who can't even resolve conflict. So how do you teach kids to do something that even adults can't do? Isn't it kind of over their heads to mediate?
Not at all, actually. I think the kids really enjoy the process of mediation because they get a chance to be heard. And the process of mediation doesn't tell the kids what to do, how to resolve their problem. That's up to the kids. And there's not a lot of places today that a kid can be, whether at home, at school, or around their friends without somebody telling them what to do or how, you know, what decision to take. And mediation doesn't focus on that. And I think when the kids realize that, they really respect the process and actually enjoy it.
Lily, talk about the natural peacemaker, because you all train students to be peer mediators. It's sort of like a third side. Are there kids who have a natural ability at that?
Absolutely. I think that all people have a natural ability to be peacemakers. So I don't think you have to be special to be a peacemaker. I think that that's something that's within all of us. But sometimes surprising people they really strive with being a peacemaker, and it's the kids that you might least expect. Sometimes the kids at schools who are kind of the opinion leaders in a negative way, who raise a little bit of cane around campus, are often the kids who are just the people that we need to have involved in a peer mediation program, because if they're given the opportunity to be a positive opinion leader and they're trained well so that way they don't misuse that power and start giving suggestions and taking on that adult, typical, traditional role, then really great things can happen, because it shows that they can transform the way they've been behaving, and it also shows that anybody can solve problems. It doesn't take somebody else to do it. We all have that within us.
And Ellie, what are some other techniques
What do you do? I'm visualizing these two students talking to each other, and one's telling a story. And isn't there a natural inclination for the other student to say, no, no, and interrupt them and say, that's not really what happened?
Mm-hmm.
So what are some techniques that mediators use to keep people calm and really listening?
Well, the first thing that we do is we like to set some ground rules. And I hate to use the word ground rules. I usually just say, you know, do some things that will help make my job easier. Mm-hmm. And one of those is showing respect to the other. And, you know, what do you guys think that looks like? That means not calling each other names. You can certainly talk about the past and what happened in the past, but not to call each other names. Try not to interrupt each other. The other thing is that lets a lot of people's guard down is by saying to them, I'm not a truth seeker. I'm not here to seek the truth because your truth is your truth and your truth is your truth. And, you know, both of you have valid stories. And I think that that makes a lot of people relax because, like, yeah, that is my perspective. And the other person can feel the same way and feel completely validated by their story.
Peace activists often say that a world at war sends the wrong message to young people. And with war so much in the headlines over the last couple of years, is there any evidence that there's more conflict in the schools, Ellie?
Well, I took this job over at the end of last summer. And so in the fall, we were getting ready to go to war. And I noticed that the mediations got off at breakneck speed. I mean, second day into school, I mean, and it almost didn't stop throughout the year. We worked with 456 students in our mediation program last year, and it was double that of the year before. So, yes, I think that what's going on in society and around the world has a very strong impact on our kids and how they're affected by it.
And I think it's particularly impacting in New Mexico, where we have such a strong military presence. You know, we have kids whose parents are being sent off to war. How are they, you know, what do you expect in terms of their response? We saw so many fights at school, and we knew that it wasn't a problem that we could deal with on a mediation-by-mediation basis, that we had to approach it as the collective problem that it was. And so we had a public meeting about it, and we just gave kids the opportunity to speak out about what they were feeling in a way where they weren't shut down, they weren't censored. They were just allowed to respond. And I can't say that it made things all better, but at least it slowed down the number of violent occurrences that were happening because I think there were like six fights broken up that first day, which is a lot, you know, to have six actual physical fights that somebody has to come and restrain folks. And so, you know, I think all people are really sensitive. Maybe young people are just more in touch with that because they are. And so they're so impacted by it. And they maybe have less resources for dealing with it. And so that's why we really, as adults, have a responsibility to be there and support them. And support doesn't mean telling them what to do. It means really listening to them and hearing where they're coming from.
That's Lily Irvin Vitella, the director of the New Mexico Center for Dispute Resolution in Albuquerque. We also heard Ellie Dendahl, who coordinates the school mediation program in Santa Fe, as well as Elena Carnes, who survived her middle school years and is now a junior at Sandia Prep. In recent years, world events have made it hard for many of us to achieve inner peace. We talked about that challenge with meditation teacher Eric Kolvig, who told us he was already a survivor of post-traumatic stress syndrome, even before the attacks of September 11th reactivated it. He explained how his meditation practice, one that promotes keeping an open heart and clear mind, helped him minimize the PTSD effects. Our studio audience had many questions for Eric that couldn't fit into the original program.
I'm Geraldine, and I also suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and had a similar triggering after 9/11, which surprised me because I didn't feel that it had affected me. I'm wondering what you see as the healing aspect of the meditative practices and that you're talking about?
It's a very important question. Just to share a little bit my own experience is that there was so much damage from trauma that I was basically told by the psychiatric community, we can't help you. There has been too much neurological change. We can maybe manage this with drugs. And basically I said to them, I don't believe that. So I think the most important healing thing is the faith that actually this can be changed. And so I just basically had the intention, if it takes me a million lifetimes, I will heal this heart from its suffering, you know, and really devoted my life to it. And finding there are now many, many different modes for healing available in this society that didn't exist 25 years ago for those of us who are survivors of trauma. So one is the intention, to have the intention to heal. That, I think, is a positive healing force. And then of all the other forms of healing, I think that love is bigger than trauma. Love is bigger than death.
Hi, I'm Judith. Eric, I have a lot of conflict. I've had it ever since 9/11 with feeling the pain in this country, but also a consciousness or a worry that we're so worried about our pain and we're not aware of what's going on in Afghanistan and the pain of that we're causing, the pain that we're a part of. And I get frustrated at what I feel sometimes is a preoccupation with our inner peace when I feel like we should be worried a little bit more about other people's struggle. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I think it's a beautiful question. I think we're so much reacting to situations rather than looking for deeper causes. My sense is that if we really want to eliminate terrorism in this world, terrorism toward us and terrorism toward others, we need to eliminate poverty in the world and injustice. We need to make a commitment to do that. And in order to eliminate poverty, we also have to be willing to reduce affluence. And what does that mean in terms of our choices as Americans? So I agree with you. There's enormous suffering in the world, and it has generated reaction. And if we really want to have a secure world, if we want to be secure as Americans, we have to make sure that everyone is secure, that they have enough on the material level in their lives. And so I agree with you absolutely. I think that, in fact, it never works, actually, for us, for a nation to believe that they can find safety and security by making war on the world. So it would be very helpful for us to start to focus on much of the suffering in the world and to try to see what are the causes of that suffering and to see is there some way that we can start to eliminate the causes. That's where we will really come to peace. So thank you.
Thank you.
Meditation teacher Eric Kolvig answering questions during our taping of the program Making Peace with Ourselves Since 9/11. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and we'll close this special edition of previously unaired excerpts from our Peace Talks tapings with a bonus conversation with Jorge Rubio, a trainer in nonviolent communication, something that can be applied to many conflict scenarios. Instead of lashing out verbally at someone, nonviolent communication suggests a four-part response. It begins with how you feel. For example, I feel frustrated when you don't return my call because I have a need to have my complaint heard. I ask that in the future you respond to me within 24 hours. Nonviolent communication expresses a feeling, observation, need, and request.
Any human message, verbal or nonverbal, can be, it has all these four components. There is always somebody who's observing something, who's feeling something about the observation. A need underneath is triggering or eliciting that or creating that feeling, and people always want something.
Would it be possible to use the components in a different order? What you're saying is it's not really important to structure it like a really rigid formula.
It's tricky. Once people start connecting with this sort of awareness, it's really a place where people arrive, where you were seeing the other person as an enemy, and suddenly you are suddenly interested in the welfare of everybody in the situation. Once you start connecting with that, then you end up talking street NVC. So you're just not really paying such attention to the structure, but you end up finding yourself using words for the service of connection. Now, having said that, I find a certain power and elegance in the ability to separate observation, to express the feeling, and then immediately connect it to the need. That's probably the crucial element here, that I say, I feel because I have a need. I connect my feelings with my needs. So in that part, we really emphasize and insist on that clarification. Conversely, if I'm listening to a message that is incoming, I like to be able to connect your feelings with your needs. So if somebody comes and says, this is the last time I schedule meetings with you, then I would guess, are you really feeling frustrated because you really have a need to have your time respected? So that's the way that we approach that. And I think it's a profound transformation from the sort of fairy tale that I have had all my life, where I always told people, thought people had the power to make me happy or miserable. And I thought of myself as a sort of deity, too, that had that power. And it's been quite a discovery for me to see that my feelings don't depend directly from the external stimulus, but they come from my met or unmet need.
Do we have any other questions or comments, scenarios?
I was talking about this with somebody today about this show, and they were talking about they had problems when people told them how they should feel or they shouldn't feel that way, you know, that was kind of that was her take on this whole thing.
Again, another of the most profound aspects that we address with NVC. I think most of the violence occurs with yourself. And a lot of the violence occurs when people are trying to be or to feel something different than what they're already feeling. We are very averse to really feel what we're feeling. And unless we do that, we cannot fully connect with that. So when we hear others trying to tell us, don't feel so angry, it usually just increases the anger because we already need understanding. And what do we get? Education. We get somebody telling us not to be in a state that we already are. So it's almost like we don't have the right to feel what we're feeling. So with empathic listening, we teach the very different strategy, which is we want to learn to demystify all different gradients of human emotion. People are so phobic to anger, for example. I like us all to work into an environment where we can hear with compassion when somebody goes there. And also internally, I like us to be more skillful with receiving whatever it is that we are sensing coming alive in us, because if we really engage with it, we have only one way to go, which is to find a need that was met or not met.
That's Jorge Rubio, a trainer in nonviolent communication. There's more about each of the original programs from which these outtakes were drawn at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated, a nonprofit media organization. There's information on how you can support the work of Good Radio Shows, Inc., also on the web at goodradioshows.org. Thanks to producer and engineer Paul Ingalls, I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.